rather long meetings today, as most of Wednesday morning's work has been done to enable key ministers to be involved with the major event around the CNI settlement, which is taking place in the Beehive on Wednesday morning. It's quite a big week for activity around treaty settlements this week. Matters before the Cabinet today. The UN mission in Kosovo is coming to an end, with Kosovo having unilaterally declared independence. New Zealand has had a military liaison officer posted in that mission for quite a number of years, but with the mission ending, obviously we'll be ending our involvement, and that will be at the end of September this year. We've agreed for amendments, policy for amendments to the Evidence Act with respect to access to video record evidence. This has been an issue raised where we need to protect child witnesses and other victims of sexual offending from having their video evidence used in a way that's undesirable. So Annette King will be advancing the amendments to the Evidence Act for that. The New Zealand transport strategy has been updated. It will have a much stronger focus on sustainability, and that will be released by Annette King in July. We've made decisions for 2009 level on maximum tertiary fees and course costs. Pete Hodgson will announce that in due course. Also agreed on policy to protect young people who are under the age for the minimum wage, who work as contractors or independent contractors, and there'll be regulations drafted under the Health and Safety and Employment Act to protect them. It's Trevor Mallard's area. We've agreed to a discussion document being released on the promotion of outdoor recreation. For a country with a great outdoors, we actually have remarkably few people involved in outdoor recreation, and Spark and the Minister of Sport and Recreation are interested in changing that, so we'll be doing a public conversation around it. We've agreed on the next steps for the transmission gully proposals, and Annette King will have something to say about that this week. We've finalised a working holidays scheme with Brazil that will be ready for signature, and it's anticipated we may have a senior Brazilian government minister in New Zealand in the next few weeks for an occasion to be found for signing. We've agreed to the release of a discussion document on an owner-builder exemption from restricted building work. There's a tremendous amount of work going on, driven by Shane Jones, around simplifying the whole building consent, building process issues. And we've also agreed to the release of the Department of Building and Housing report on its review of the Building Code, issued subsequent to the Building Act 2004. Also finalised details around how the Screen Production Incentive Fund for domestic movies will operate, and I'll be in a position to announce the outcome of that shortly. We've made the substantive decisions around the governance structure and establishment of the New Zealand Fast Forward Fund. That's the one we announced the $700 million capital contribution to. We've finalised the government policy statement on land transport funding. That will be released in July at the same time as the update of the New Zealand Transport Strategy. We've agreed to refer the proposal that we ratify the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities for select committee scrutiny in the normal way. And there'll be some minor legislation associated with New Zealand coming into compliance with that after we ratify. We've considered a significant paper from Leanne Dalziel on an omnibus sale of liquor and liquor enforcement bill. It will contain amendments which address youth drinking issues, particularly around the supply of liquor to minors, and also in improving community input into licensing decisions, and we're endeavouring to define better where off licences can be granted, what the size of store, what nature of store. The bill is likely to pick up the issues that George Hawkins has put in his bill as well, and require district licensing authorities and the liquor licensing authority to give effect to local alcohol strategies. And those strategies, which the local authorities, who are the district licensing agencies, will be able to promulgate, would be expected to cover hours of opening, the latest entry into the shop, outlet density or minimum proximity to other outlets, minimum proximity to other types of premises, including schools, and responsible business practices and event management. So this is quite a substantial bill that is now being prepared around that. As I indicated last Monday, there has been a lot of activity around central government agencies in Wellington and their representatives in the county's Manukau area, following on the focus on crime in the Manurewa area. The chief executives did meet last Wednesday and looking at how they can work through their existing networks in the regions to give additional support in the Manurewa area. And those ideas then fed through into the meeting of the Youth Support Network for Counties Manukau of Tahuhu, which took place on Friday. And the senior representatives of government agencies there, convened by the Auckland head of the Ministry of Social Development, Isabel Evans, with local top police personnel and others represented, agreed on a 10-point plan to action in the short term to build on the experience of the Mount Roskill Pacific Patrols, to bring that concept into the Manurewa area and then later into other hotspots in counties Manukau, to improve the support for the Māori wardens, who are already doing a great deal but need a community base and additional transport to be fully effective. There was discussion about the need for additional youth workers in Manurewa and a commitment to boost with two additional youth workers in the very near term and three integrated case management workers, and to continue funding for a youth sports coordinator. Also a decision that central government should give support to the John Walker Find Your Field of Dreams sports-based program, getting that into the Manurewa area. That's thought to be very worthwhile for engaging young people in more constructive activities. Supporting a revamp of neighbourhood support in the area, which is not extensive through all parts of Manurewa, which are affected by the problems that we've seen. Introducing a program around the Housing New Zealand tenancy areas to monitor vacant housing stock in between tenancies, called a Responsible Guardian program, which would reduce vandalism and increase community awareness. And it should also be said that, independently of recent events, Housing New Zealand is looking to make very substantial change in some of the intensive areas of housing that it has, in areas like Rata Vine, which includes demolition and actually remodelling and redesign of those neighbourhoods to minimise problems. There's going to be investigation of a youth drop-in and information centre in the area, based on the Otara Youth Library model, to be run by young people themselves and have a focus of services there, and so on through a list of such initiatives, with the police also raising their visibility in the area. Now, coming up this week in the House, we expect on Tuesday to be doing the first reading of the Affiliate Te Arawa Iwi and Hapu Claims Settlement Bill, and Wednesday to be doing the first reading of the Central North Island Forestry Claims Settlement Bill, otherwise known as the Tree Lords Deal. We have the three-hour debate on the estimates and impressed supply on Tuesday. Hope during the week to advance the ACC bill, number two, which is on the order paper, the major transport bill, with any luck, and the organised crime penalties and sentencing bill is on the order paper for progress this week if possible, or if not, next. As I said, quite a lot of activity around treaty settlements this week. Come Tuesday, Annette King should be announcing the next stage with Transmission Gully, as I indicated earlier. There will be an announcement from Rick Barker in Auckland tomorrow about planning for Auckland court services to improve them. Obviously quite a lot of activity with ministers at select committees for estimates this week. And we have on Thursday morning the Central Government, Local Government Forum, which takes place every 6 months. GDP figures out Friday. Now, just a word on Zimbabwe, which obviously is an issue of huge concern internationally. And it is indeed a tragic and abhorrent state of affairs when a man who has topped the poll in the first round of a presidential election then finds that he and his party and his supporters and voters are so intimidated and terrified by thuggery, brutality and murder that he cannot proceed to the poll. This is not democracy by any definition known to humankind. Mr. Mugabe has said that only God can remove him from the position, from which one infers that he believes he will be carried out, not ever voted out. This is an abhorrent state of affairs. We understand that the United Nations Security Council may be discussing Zimbabwe tomorrow, and we believe it should condemn the tactics of Mr. Mugabe's regimes in unequivocal terms and very strong terms, and insist upon the creation of conditions in Zimbabwe which will enable a runoff election to be conducted freely and fairly. The only silver lining on this terrible thundercloud is that opinion in Africa has begun to speak out, be heard against the regime. And this is a new development. The Security Council has not been able to deal effectively with Zimbabwe in the past because of the silence of the neighbours. That silence is now being broken, and the statement from the 40 significant African statespersons was also extremely helpful. Obviously, should the Mugabe regime persist, we, like other like-minded countries, will be looking at how we might strengthen our measures against Zimbabwe. But the preference is for this matter to come to a head so that the people of Zimbabwe can truly test who they want to lead them into the future. Any questions?
The language coming from Thabo Mbeki, though, is still really talking about mediation between the groups. It's not very strong at this stage.
No. No, it's not very strong, and it's clear that South Africa has been a major force against Southern Africa in general speaking out. But the silence there has now been shattered by quite strong statements from, for example, the President of Angola, from the Foreign Minister of Tanzania, who's been heading an election monitoring group there. So people are beginning to speak out, the former President of Botswana. And I think South Africa really now needs to follow the lead of others and look to make it clear to Mr. Mugabe in the strongest possible terms that it is not supporting in any form the continuation of the regime that he runs.
Do you think that will make any difference to Mr. Mugabe?
No? I think that the continuation of South African support has been very important to Mr. Mugabe, and it must be remembered that something like a third of the population of Zimbabwe has emptied out and gone over the border to South Africa. That's created terrific strains on South Africa, and indeed South Africa has experienced horrific violence against refugees from other countries in recent times, so it would seem to be very much in South Africa's interests to get an outcome from this which enables Zimbabwe to return to being the more peaceful nation than we once knew it as.
One of the arguments is that because Robert Mugabe has gone so far, he knows he would face from criminal charges and the like if he gives up power, and that's why he won't. I mean, in that sense, do you think there's a possibility and should a deal be done with him to get him out?
Well, it may be that some have in mind some kind of accommodation like the one that was reached in Kenya. There was horrific post-election violence in Kenya, ethnic cleansing by a tribal group. In the end, there was a negotiation which enabled the two sides to work together, and to this date that deal is holding. Now, whether events in Zimbabwe have gone so far with now so little trust that such an arrangement could work, I don't know. But clearly the most desirable outcome would be for Mr. Mugabe to vacate the scene and let someone committed to the welfare of Zimbabwe and its people take the reins.
You talk about the Australians stepping up these actions. Is there any discussion about that from New Zealand?
Certainly we'll be talking with other like-minded nations to see what measures might be taken. We do, of course, have tribal sanctions, financial sanctions, I believe, with respect to the Zimbabwe regime.
What sanctions do you envision we could take?
Well, it's a question really of talking with others about what further measures might be taken. Obviously, we have three parts of no trade with Zimbabwe. We don't offer aid to the regime as a bilateral partner. Our support has gone in a small way to local groups, so we need to discuss with others what measures might be appropriate.
The tragic downside to all that, of course, is the people themselves suffer.
They can't suffer anymore. With 165,000% inflation, with murder, torture, it's almost impossible to think that things could be any worse. I think what the international community now wants to see is this move to an end game and change pretty quickly.
Back home, it's talking of Clinton, the group setting up themselves, vigilantes, if you like, in South Auckland. They're calling themselves, I think, the Asian Anti-Crime Unit. What's your reaction to news that people obviously feel the police aren't responding enough, they have to set up their own crime unit?
I wouldn't want to see in New Zealand the development of vigilante-style groups. I think that's completely opposite to our culture. We have a community-based police force. It is there to work alongside the community and to respond quickly and effectively. Now, there will always be debate from time to time as to whether that happened, but I would urge those who have those concerns to keep working with the local police force on a good community-based response.
Do you think there is a sense, though, in that community that they're just not being responsive? I mean, especially after the murder of the liquor store owner, where people felt that he's left to die while the police and ambulance were waiting outside?
Well, I think only a coroner's inquest will tell us whether the time taken for the police to enter the premise had a material effect on that. Clearly, Mr. Singh was terribly badly wounded. We await the coroner's inquest to say whether he was mortally wounded. But the police overwhelmingly are a strong community-based force, and it's important that our communities work alongside them for the best law and order results.
Those concerns about violent crime obviously arising in Hawke's Bay in Southland over the weekend, and there's been calls there for more to be done to combat gangs. I mean, is the government doing all it can do in that area? Are you thinking of doing even more in that area?
As we signalled last week and actually tabled a bill which increases the penalty for participation in an organised criminal gang, the increased penalty, of course, enables the police then to use more effective measures to detect such crime. When you take it up from 5 to 10 years, you then have interception powers available which weren't there before. And also the new provision proposed in the law, which it's clear there's a strong majority for in Parliament, which would enable participation in an organised criminal group to be taken into account when the judge is sentencing. So those are two specific measures. Obviously, there's the organised crime strategy that's been developed. There's a new agency being set up in the police. I have to say, though, that the Minister of Police is advised by the police that gang activity is not increasing. It's on the decrease, just as crime overall has been on the decrease, as you would expect, as we've been in an era of near full employment for a number of years. But unfortunately, no society has reached the state of perfection where there is no crime. And the battle we're all engaged in is how to reduce to the lowest possible minimum the acts of violence and crime in our community. And that's a quest that will continue throughout our lifetimes and those of future generations.
But will those organised crime provisions cover the sort of, if you like, street thuggery that was evident in Hawke's Bay over the weekend, which was clearly a gang?
If they're a member of an organised gang, the offence for that increases, and the fact that they are a member will be taken into account when being sentenced on other matters. In other words, the sentence will be harsher where they are participants in an organised criminal gang.
How often over the weekend, you said this morning that they were excessive and basically wrong. What were your reasons?
The word I used was that they are somewhat extreme, but look, I'm not going to get into the business of commenting on every poll. I have always thought that this year was challenging. I acknowledge that we are running behind. The question is by how much. I think the election is going to come down to a contest during the campaign of solid policy, plan for the future, vision for the future of our country, against what at this time is a yawning chasm, a vacuum, free of ideas, and that's when it starts to get interesting, and that's when you start to see it narrow up.
A year on from the so-called anti-smacking legislation, how do you think things have gone?
Well, very little evidence that I can see of good parents being dragged before a court. The whole idea of removing the defence of reasonable force, which over time judges and juries had pushed a bulldozer through, was to ensure that where force by any definition was unreasonable, the police could prosecute with a reasonable likelihood of getting a conviction. The whole aim is to deal to serious violence in our families.
What do you make of the petition that's been going around with all these people signing and saying
that? Well, that's obviously been handed into Parliament, and they'll go through the same process as they did before of scrutinising and seeing whether it meets the threshold.
But do you think it would be a step backwards if we were to have a referendum?
Well, when Parliament passes a piece of legislation by something like 113-8, as it did in the case of this bill, I think it tells you that Parliament is speaking with near unanimous mind.
Could a referendum be up and running?
I wouldn't think so, no.
Why?
Well, just in terms of sheer organisation, I don't think that's possible.